Following is an introduction to Shakespeare's Henry V. Introduction: Henry V and Tudor Pride. Shakespeare's ideal sovereign seems to have been Queen Elizabeth I, who reigned from 1558 to 1603. Elizabeth knew how to engage in politics like a Machiavellian operator, but this strong sovereign was also genuinely revered by many of her people. Shakespeare himself lived most of his life in the time of her iconic reign. He lived from 1564 to 1616. The Tudor Elizabeth I's long tenure was marked by what today we would call a shrewd concern for public relations, that is, for managing the Queen's image and keeping the various segments of the populace favorable towards her policies. The cult of the Virgin Queen, so-called, encouraged by Elizabeth's officials and courtiers and literary men like Edmund Spenser, proved a successful means of maintaining order in her court. The Queen was often advised and implored to marry, but doing so would have meant diminished power for herself and an increase in dominion for the lucky continental suitor, a man such as Spain's Catholic King Philip II, who reigned from 1556 to 1598. Henry V, the subject of the present drama, must have been high on the playwright's list of proper sovereigns as well, to judge from the accolades Henry receives in the history play that bears his name. His father, Henry Bolingbroke, who became Henry IV after taking the crown from the last directly Plantagenet ruler, Richard II, in 1399, was the son of John of Gaunt, 1st Duke of Lancaster, and third surviving son of King Edward III, and John's first wife Blanche of Lancaster. So, Bolingbroke's son, upon ascending the throne in 1413 at the age of 26, as Henry V, continued the Lancastrian line. That Henry V was a Lancastrian matters, because the first Tudor king, Henry VII, who vanquished the Yorkist Richard III at Bosworth Field in 1485, was himself head of that great house by virtue of his mother, Margaret Beaufort, great-granddaughter of John of Gaunt by his third wife, Catherine Swynford. So, while Henry VII basically united the houses of York and Lancaster by marrying Elizabeth of York, King Edward IV's daughter by his queen, Elizabeth Woodville, the Tudors and their historians, men such as Raphael Holinshed and John Stowe, strongly favored the Lancastrian version of the English past. It would be natural, then, for Shakespeare, who partly follows Raphael Holinshed's Tudor-friendly Chronicles of England, Scotland, and Ireland, 1586, to offer a positive, though not merely flattering, reconstruction of the reign of the Lancastrian Henry V, and that is mostly what we get in his play by that name. Modern historicist critics have offered a counter-reading that sees deep irony at work in Henry V. An early example of this is Regency Republican author William Hazlitt, who criticizes the play Henry V for its willingness to applaud a king whom he considers a brute. In The Round Table, Hazlitt writes that, quote-unquote, Henry, because he did not know how to govern his own kingdom, determined to make war upon his neighbors. Because his own title to the crown was doubtful, he laid claim to that of France. See The Characters of Shakespeare's Plays, Henry V, Gutenberg E-Text. Still, it's difficult to see how the most valued member of the Lord Chamberlain's men during Elizabeth I's reign, and then of the King's Men Theatre Company for James I, could be expected to be anything but pro-royalist. Shakespeare was very likely a believer, at least to some extent, in the Renaissance's prime image of earthly order, the great chain of being, wherein everything has its place and God sanctions the order of things. He is unlikely to have been sympathetic to republicanism. This is not to say that Shakespeare is a shameless mouthpiece for the powers that be. We can see from Henry V and other plays that he does not support monarchy blindly. The strengths and weaknesses of his characters amount to something like the admonitory representations we see of famous people in The Mirror for Magistrates, a popular text in and around Shakespeare's time. Shakespeare never tears the institution of kingship down, but in the end, the advice Henry V gives in our play holds good. Quote unquote, "The king is but a man." And a man, in the view of Renaissance authors, is for the most part a collection of virtues and vices, just like every other individual, highborn or not. There are plenty of sin-riddled or otherwise wrong-headed rulers in Shakespeare's canon, and they never fare well. But this leads us to a consideration of Henry V as a character. Romantic poets, such as Samuel Taylor Coleridge, in his Lectures on Shakespeare, have written about the way many of this playwright's characters manage to be both strong individuals and yet representatives of a class of people. Coleridge writes in an essay on Romeo and Juliet, quote unquote, "The character of the nurse is the nearest of anything in Shakespeare to a direct borrowing from mere observation. And the reason is that, as in infancy and childhood, the individual in nature is a representative of a class. Just as in describing one larch tree, you generalize a grove of them, so it is nearly as much so in old age." So Coleridge implies that there is something universal about the nurse's eccentric individual behavior. She is an uneducated but good-hearted old woman, and all such people show similar tendencies in their speech and conduct. In that sense, suggests Coleridge, the nurse is a universally human character even as she displays her exuberant particular personality. In a similar way, Henry V is the type of a good king. He achieves this paradigmatic status because over the course of three plays, Henry IV Parts 1 and 2 plus Henry V, Shakespeare allows Prince Hal to transform himself from a playful rascal into a sovereign of iron will and implacable virtue, the burden of which role is at times lightened by the sense of humor that comes from being kicked around by life enough to acknowledge his own limitations, amongst them, spiritual error and common mortality. In sum, Shakespeare's Henry V is neither a saintly or perfect ruler, nor a thoroughly bad one, but something in between. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Friday, October 31st, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.